Reformation in England, the 21st talk in a series titled History of Christian Thought, was presented by David Crabtree on April 4, 1988, for McKinsey Study Center School of Exegesis. McKinsey Study Center is now an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2013. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side. The following recording was made in a classroom setting, and many of the students' questions were inaudible. It is hoped that Dr. Crabtree's answers will be sufficient to understand the context.
There are a couple of things left from last lecture that I would like to clarify on Calvin. One is, I said that Luther was conservative and that Calvin was more radical. And that there's a sense in which that's true, but there's a sense in which the opposite is true. Luther was liturgically conservative and ethically radical. So as far as the church tradition and stuff, he wanted to retain as much as possible, and he was reluctant to give any of that up. But when it came to charting Christian ethics, he took the perspective that if it is not taught in the New Testament, then it is not binding on us. He was the one who said that the law of Moses is not binding on us. But Calvin, on the other hand, was liturgically radical. He was willing to throw out most anything. Not as much as Zwingli, but by comparison with Luther, he was radical. But ethically, he was conservative. And his perspective was, if it is not rescinded in the New Testament, if an Old Testament command is not rescinded in the New Testament, then it ought to be obeyed. Okay, so, because, well, I was afraid that I left that. If it's not rescinded, if it's not annulled by the teaching of the New Testament, then it must be obeyed. It's rescinded?
Yeah.
The dietary laws. No, the dietary laws were done away with. In the vision to Peter, the dietary laws were done away with. And there are other things like that. For instance, the sacrifices at the temple are not necessary because of Christ. Luther's perspective is the way Lutherans, after Luther, the way the Lutherans usually stated it was that if it is not restated in the New Testament, an Old Testament commandment, then it need not be followed by us. We don't need to follow it. Now, that wasn't quite Luther's position, as I understand it. Luther's position was, natural law tells us which moral laws are binding. That if we look carefully at how the world is ordered and how it works, that natural law, that is just looking at it, will tell us what actions are harmful. So his perspective was radical. Was more radical than the later Lutherans. Jailbreak, which I was glad to read, by the way, about, comes closer to what my perspective would be. And I didn't know I could get help from those quarters. Now, the other thing that was brought up was the trial of Michael Servetus. No, but ethically I would be considered radical. I mean, I hate to use that term, because I wouldn't call myself that, but my perspective is seen as being radical. Because I would agree that none of the commandments in either the New Testament or the Old Testament are necessarily binding on us. Because none of them were given to us. They were all given to someone else. So we have to go through the process of figuring out, why were those given to those people? What is the principle that lies behind those commandments? And then determine whether that applies to us or not. The trial of Servetus. Let me just read a couple paragraphs. The singular case of Servetus has become the most celebrated of executions by fire for heretical teaching. Michael Servetus of Villanova in Aragon was educated in theology, law, and medicine. At Toulouse, he read the Bible and took it as authoritative, but employing his speculative gifts, drew from it the basis of a drastic revision of traditional beliefs. He traveled widely, forming the acquaintance of Melanchthon, Oecolampadius, Bucer, and other theologians who sought in vain to modify his startling opinions. His work on the errors of the Trinity affrighted the theologians. A marked man, he followed Calvin's example by disguising his name, calling himself Villeneuve from the family estate of Villanova. At Paris, he became a brilliant medical scholar and wrote on various scientific subjects. For years, he practiced medicine at Vienna. Through a third party, he engaged Calvin in an epistolary controversy, in the course of which Calvin detected that Villeneuve was that Servetus who had once failed to honor an appointment with him in Paris and who had challenged the doctrine of the Trinity. A copy of the Institutes, that's Calvin's Christian Institutes, sent for his instruction was returned with copious and contemptuous marginal notes. In long letters, he proposed to deliver Calvin from his delusions. As a thinker, Servetus was learned, original, challenging, and resourceful, but disorderly. He crowned his theological revolt by his Christianismi Restitutio, directed for the most part against Calvin's institutions. 30 letters to Calvin are inserted in it, and a section on the Trinity is addressed to Melanchthon. Servetus regarded the doctrine of infant baptism as diabolical, and he denied original sin. But it was his assault upon the doctrine of the Trinity that attracted most attention. The traditional Trinity is likened to him by him to a three-headed Cerberus. The Godhead is indivisible. The mystery of the one in three is rejected. Jesus was not eternal Son, but was human and became divine. Because of the Trinitarian error, Jews and Mohammedans deride Christian stupidity and are repelled from Christianity. Servetus casts himself in the role of another Michael, the archangel leading the angelic host against the minions of the Antichrist. Calvin soon obtained a copy of the Restitutio. To his mind, it was a rhapsody patched together from the impious ravings of all the ages. As early as February 1546, referring to a letter of Servetus, Calvin had written that should the heretic come to Geneva, he would use that authority he might have to prevent his getting away alive. The enmity of Calvin now reached Servetus in Vienna. William of de Tree of Lyon lived in Geneva and was in Calvin's confidence. He informed a Roman Catholic correspondent in Lyon that Villeneuve, the physician, was Servetus the heretic and the author of the Restitutio. Pages from the book and manuscript materials supplied by Calvin were sent in evidence, though, as de Tree stated, these were drawn from Calvin with the greatest difficulty and after an earnest plea. No real reason has been shown to doubt this statement. Had he wished, Calvin might have exposed Servetus to the Inquisition years earlier, but he must have known that the documents would be of the greatest interest to any inquisitors who might see them. So indeed it proved. At Vienna, Servetus was tried, and after much prevarication about his identity and other matters, was in danger of his life when he escaped an inattentive jailer. He was sentenced in absence to be burned alive and was burned in effigy with much of the stock of his new book. He hoped to reach Naples, but a fatal fascination drew him to Geneva like a moth to the candle flame. He was a guest at the Golden Rose on Sunday, August 13, 1553, having arranged to take a boat on the way to Zurich. He attended church, was recognized, accused by Calvin, arrested, and imprisoned. Calvin fully acknowledged his part in the detention of Servetus and in the preparation of charges of heresy against him, adding, however, "I never moved to have him punished with death." This is possibly true in a literal sense, if he certainly hoped that Servetus would be punished and had vowed 7 years earlier to bring him to death if he could. He goes on to say that Calvin did ask that he after he had been tried and convicted of heresy, he was to be burned to death. And Calvin asked that he not be burned to death, but rather he be beheaded because it was most painful. And that was denied. And then Calvinists, in years after that, after the death of Calvin, after the death of Calvin, Calvinists unanimously denounced that action of putting Servetus to death. So that's as much as I know. But Calvin says that he wanted him to be punished, but he didn't want him to be put to death. The author of this book doubts that that's true, however. But it is known that having been tried and been convicted and sentenced to death by burning, Calvin asked for a more lenient sentence for Servetus.
But he didn't ask for pardon.
What?
More lenient?
Yes. The English, speaking of heads rolling, the English Reformation. The English Reformation is bizarre, and it's more political than it is. I mean, every step is politically in control, and so it becomes a very messy Reformation. But there are some interesting features to it, and some of what happened in the English Reformation can still be felt in our society today. You'll see where some of the denominations that exist today came from. It all started with Henry VIII, who reigned between those years, 1509 to 1547. Now here's how my handy-dandy chart works. The first row, that is the preeminent group during that particular king, preeminent religious group. The second row is that religious group which lended support to the king. And the third row is that religious group which was persecuted under the reign of that king to one degree or another. That there was nobody fit in that category. To the king.
To the king.
Yeah, basically in his religious policies. And the bottom row were the ones that were persecuted. Okay, it started with Henry VIII. Henry VIII, as you notice, lived the same time as Luther lived. Henry VIII was in a predicament. His father, who had been the king before him, wanted to increase his financial resources. And he did so by marrying his son, who was the brother of Henry VIII. He married that son to the daughter of the King of Spain, Catherine of Aragon. They were married, and she brought her dowry into the household of Henry VIII's father. Unfortunately, Henry VIII's brother died fairly soon after that event, and Catherine wanted to go home and take her dowry with her. Henry's father couldn't afford that loss of funds, so he came with a clever idea. He decided he would marry Catherine to Henry VIII, which by church law was illegal. It was incest, because he had already been married to Henry VIII's brother. So they had to get special permission from the Pope. Both the King of Spain and Henry VIII's father convinced the Pope to give them a special permission for Catherine and Henry VIII to marry. So they were married. She wanted to go home. So Henry VIII was watching events in Germany, and what he noticed was that the princes in Germany were saying, we're no longer going to be controlled by the Pope, and lo and behold, they were no longer controlled by the Pope. The Lutheran princes were breaking away from the control of the Catholic Church successfully. Henry VIII said, I'm going to try that. Sounds like a good idea. So he broke away from the Catholic Church for this main reason of making it possible for him to divorce Catherine and marry someone else. He was primarily motivated by a desire to have a legitimate heir. Catherine and Henry VIII had only one child, a female, Mary, and he wanted a male child so that the dynasty would be more secure. England had come through a long period of dynastic wars just prior to Henry VIII, and he didn't want England to go through another series of dynastic wars. So with noble motives, he broke away from the Catholic Church and set up his own church under the leadership of Cranmer. Cranmer. Who was a very obliging sort of fellow and basically did what Henry VIII wanted him to do. He annulled the marriage between Henry VIII and Catherine because it was unlawful to begin with, and Henry VIII was able to marry Anne Boleyn. So what happened is that he began a church that was basically Catholic. The only difference was it was separate from papal control. Very few changes, liturgically or theologically. A few structural changes, for instance, I think during the monasteries were busted up. Initially, monasteries were broken up voluntarily. But they were just, any monastery that wanted to disband was allowed to do so. Time went on, Henry sped up the process and disbanded monasteries by force. And then the property from the monasteries, which were very wealthy, there were a lot of large monasteries in England. They were a major force. In the past, that had been a source of papal control in England. The kings of England had to obey the Pope because of his wealth in England. And so that's one of the reasons Henry wanted to speed up the process of busting up the monasteries. He would bust up the monasteries, and then he would give the money to his followers, which made them even better followers, because they did not want that property to be turned back over to the church. He had lots of wives at various degrees, degrees of legitimacy. She had Elizabeth. He had quite a few wives. And lots of concubines. He issued what is called the Ten Articles of 1536. They were issued by Cranmer. It affirmed the authority of Scripture, and that is going to be a theme that we'll see throughout this, that's the one thing that holds all the reformers together, is that they insist upon the primacy of Scripture as our authority. 1536. He affirmed the authority of Scripture and the ancient creeds and the first four ecumenical councils. Now, it doesn't denounce the other ecumenical councils, it's just silent on them, but it leaves you with the impression that maybe the others are suspect. It said that there are three sacraments, the Eucharist, baptism, and penance. It affirmed transubstantiation. It said that salvation is by faith and works, which was the Catholic position at the time. It said that liturgy in the churches should be performed in English, and images, prayers for the dead, purgatory, prayers of the saints, etc., were all retained. So there is very little shift theologically, except that the position of authority in the church has shifted from the Pope to Scripture and the first ecumenical councils, and we have kind of a nationalistic appeal of the liturgy being spoken in English. Later, in 1539, Henry decided that a reformation in England had gone a little too far, and he turned conservative, turned against the Protestants who had been supporting him. And as a result, many of them fled to Switzerland. So we have the first flight to Europe, and most of them went to Switzerland. What he did is in the six articles of 1539, he said that anyone who denies transubstantiation is a heretic and will be put to death. And any cleric who is not celibate will be declared a heretic and put to death. In other words, anyone who was a cleric had to put away his wife if he took one during the interim between 1536 and 1539. And many of them did. Many of them took wives during that period of time. And so now, in 1539, they're told either get rid of your wives or you'll be killed. And so many of them decided they rather take a trip to Europe. Well, King Henry is dictating all this stuff. I don't know who actually put out this article. This is all Henry VIII was thoroughly in control. But what he wanted to do was have this minor reformation, that is, just a change in who everybody in the church saw as their leader. And he wanted a change basically to him from the Pope. But he wanted very little else changed. But when he first got things going, Protestant thinking within England began to be encouraged and it grew. There had been reformers before this, clerics. I've talked about a little bit about Wycliffe and Tyndale, and there were others. And there were the Lollards that were sent out by Wycliffe. Luther's writings were readily available in England. So there were quite a number of people that were influenced by what was happening on the continent. So when Henry VIII just kind of got things started, they saw that as a real positive sign, and they started to take the ball and run with it. But then Henry said, wait a minute, this isn't what you think it is. This isn't a real reformation, this is something else. This is just a changing of the guard. And then he wanted to put a stop to things. He was afraid they'd go too far. He died in 1547. Then we have Edward VI, who came on the stage. He was young, very young. And so he never did really rule. There were two regents that ruled in his stead. First it was the Duke of Somerset and then the Duke of Northumberland. Both of them were sympathetic towards Protestantism. As a result, the Protestants, the ones who really wanted a reformation, moved into ascendancy. Cranmer, for some reason, was able to survive throughout the reign of Henry VIII and into the reign of Edward VI, only to be put to death by Mary. As I understand it, Cranmer was married the whole time as well. He had married the niece of one of the Lutheran theologians, a niece of Osiander, when he was traveling in Europe. And so he was married all this time, and how he kept it secret from the king, I don't know. Cranmer then gained power under the two regents. They trusted him, and he was able to display some of his own theological beliefs a little bit more easily. And he happened to be sympathetic with Reformed theology. He slowly came to those conclusions. His thinking evolved very slowly, but as time went on, he became more and more Reformed in his thinking. He renounced the six articles, declared that the clergy can marry, which was good for him because he was married. And during his time, there was a Book of Common Prayer that was written. It's called Book of Common Prayer in 1549, which revised the liturgy that had existed during the time of Henry VIII, which was, for the most part, Catholic. And it did away with a lot of the Catholic terminology. For instance, instead of priest, it would say presbyter. And instead of the altar, it would say the table. Because in the Catholic understanding, the Eucharist was a sacrifice, and it happened on the altar. Well, that kind of wording was done away with, and it became a table instead of the altar, etc. A lot of changes of that nature. 1549. And then in 1542, it was revised and made even more reformed. So during this time, the Protestants who were living in the mainland in exile discovered that circumstances had changed in England such that they could return. So this is when we have exiles, refugees who had been living in Geneva and Zurich and had been studying under the Reformed theologians in Switzerland. They are coming back to England and bringing a heavy dose of Reformed theology. To a lesser extent, there were people who had been influenced by the Lutheran teachings in Germany, and they returned as well. But primarily it's the Calvinists coming back from Switzerland that have an impact. John Hooper, Nicholas Ridley, and Hugh Latimer are the most significant ones. Edward VI died, unfortunately, for the Protestants. And Mary, who was the daughter of Henry VIII and Catherine of Aragon, she claimed the throne. She had grown up in Spain. She was rabidly Catholic, and she was determined to return England to Catholicism under the power of the Pope. She's a sad person. She was married to a young man don't remember who it was, but she wanted to have an heir very badly so that she could carry on her policies. And on several occasions, she convinced herself that she was about to have a baby. And the bells were rung and all sorts of things, and nothing happened. So she died childless and full of self-pity and all that sort of thing. During her reign, however, she went around killing anyone who was favorable towards Protestantism. That's why she earned the name Bloody Mary and then gave that name to a drink. But she killed Cranmer, she killed John Hooper, Nicholas Ridley, Hugh Latimer. Virtually everybody who came back from Europe was killed by her. This would be a Tudor. This is the beginning. Let's see. This is the beginning of the Stuarts, right? These are the Tudors, I think. Yeah, she on a number of occasions she thought she was
pregnant.
Yeah. The story with Cranmer is interesting. She asked him to recount all of his Protestant beliefs, and he signed a document recanting. And they sentenced him to death by burning anyway. And just before he was to be put to death, he said that the only reason he had recanted was because he had wanted to save his life, and that he was very sorry that he had recanted. And so he stuck out the hand with which he signed it into the fire, and that burned first. And a lot of people saw these executions, in particular this one, and it had a very big impact. These people were martyrs, and the population recognized these people as being different than other executions, because Cranmer and these other people were dying for their beliefs, not because of political intrigue. In the past, what was typical was to see people executed because of political intrigue. Well, none of these were tainted by political intrigue. They were dying for their beliefs. And that had a big impact on the population. As a result, Mary, by the time she died, was hated. She had tried to reintroduce Catholicism, but the result had been to turn the population against that because of her excesses. So the next person on the throne is Elizabeth. And I don't know what number goes with her. But she's the daughter of Henry VIII and Anne Boleyn, I think. And she kind of walked a careful line. She encouraged the Protestants, but she didn't encourage the real radical Protestants. So during her time, we begin to have three camps develop within the Protestant. At first, they're united. At the first part of her reign, they're united, and they're supporting her, and she is favorable towards them. But as time goes on, we get the development of three different camps. One camp are those Protestants who want the church to be a state church, but they want it to be separate from papal control, and they want only moderate reforms in the church. And those are basically the Anglicans, what later developed into the Anglicans. And I'm going to change this to the Anglicans, because the ones who support her throughout her reign are the Anglicans. At the beginning, the Puritans also supported her heavily, but as time went on, it's the Anglicans that provided the most support, not the Puritans down here. The other group is called the Puritans. They, too, wanted a state church. They wanted one united church under state control. But what was different is they wanted complete reform. They wanted a church that was biblical, what they considered to be biblical, and they were fanatical about it, and they were uncompromising. The third group were what they come along later in her reign, and they are the independents. They are the ones who want the church to be separate from the state. They are basically Puritan in theology. They only differ with the Puritans in ecclesiology. That is their theology of what the church should be. So what they wanted was a church separate from the state, and they developed into the groups, the Baptists, what we know today as the Baptists, and the Congregationalists. Those are the independents. Theologically, at this time, they were reformed. They were basically like the Puritans, and the Puritans were reformed. very much Calvinistic in theology. The Baptists and the Congregationalists, those two denominations developed out of the independents. Okay, so at the beginning, Elizabeth was supported by all of the Protestants. They were united, having come out of the persecution under Mary. But as time went on, they splintered into these three factions, the Anglicans, the Puritans, and the Independents. And she was most supportive of the Anglicans, but she tried to kind of balance it out and walk a line of tolerance to all three groups. The Catholics, however, were persecuted under this reign. No. This was probably the worst persecution of the whole period of time. Now, James I came along, and I think this is a new house here. I think these are now the Tudors, but I'm not sure. 1603 to 1625, he wanted to move things back towards the Catholic Church, back an Anglican church that was a lot like the Catholic Church. He tried to move things back, but he didn't do anything very dramatic in that direction. And he was quite politically, or fairly politically astute, at least by comparison with his heir, Charles I. Charles I was politically naive. James I and Charles I were rulers over both England and Scotland. Now, the reason that's important is because Scotland had become thoroughly Presbyterian, thoroughly Calvinistic. John Knox, who had spent time in Switzerland studying under the Reformers, he returned to Scotland after the death of one of the kings, and I can't remember who it was, in Scotland, and basically led a Reformation in Scotland. I don't know enough to say. They went to the Netherlands, I think it's during the time of James I. Then they go to America. No, it'd be 1620-something. Wasn't it 1629? The Puritans hadn't split off, hadn't come together as a group until Elizabeth, the time of Elizabeth. And I think it's under James I that they went to the Netherlands, and the Netherlands had just become Calvinistic at that time. And during this time, as you can see, it gets worse. Charles I is even more favorable towards Catholicism. Things became worse for Puritans in England, so they went to America. Okay, in Scotland, John Knox had returned, led a Reformation in Scotland, converted it to Calvinism, and the form of church government was Presbyterian. So Presbyterianism develops there in Scotland. When did he go back? I don't know. It's before 1603. He returned to Scotland. Okay. James I became the king of both Scotland and England. And as a result, he had to be careful. He couldn't be too anti-Calvinistic because he would run into heavy opposition. But he wanted to steer the country back towards an Anglican theology. Both a little bit, but primarily England. He has better chances in England at this time. Charles I pursues that policy more vigorously and less intelligently and ends up losing his head. In 1648, he basically loses power, and in 1649, he loses his head. He's beheaded. And he persecuted both the Puritans and the Independents during this time, trying to move it back towards Catholicism. The person who took over was Cromwell, who was an Independent. He was the leader of the army in England. He was an Independent, and all of the major players in his government were Independents. John Milton was part of his government. And what they wanted was toleration. And during his time in power, there was more religious toleration than there had been in any other, under anyone else in this time period that's on the board. He was, I don't know whether he was a Baptist or a Congregationalist, but there were certain benefits that came to the Baptists and the Congregationalists as a result of his coming to power, but the Anglicans were allowed to worship as they wanted, and the state didn't meddle in their affairs. The Puritans were allowed to set up their own churches, and the state didn't meddle in their affairs. And we have the Quakers developing, Quakers and other Anabaptist groups developing during the time of Cromwell because they were not persecuted. Well, I had heard that too, and I think the reason is because I think things were fairly bloody right at the beginning, and people were killed for political reasons. But religiously, it was very tolerant, at least according to my sources. Apparently, though, the country did fairly well under his rule. He was fairly well liked. He died of natural causes, with his head still attached. His son, though, the obvious choice to be the heir, was absolutely incompetent. And as a result, Charles II laid his claim to the throne and was able to become the king. He appointed a fellow by the name of Charles Laud to be his advisor, his religious advisor, and I think he was appointed the Archbishop of Canterbury. Laud wanted to establish an Anglican church which was as close to the Catholic theology and liturgy as possible. And in fact, he carried out negotiations with the Pope to try to reunite the Church of England with the Pope. He was killed later for doing so, but he was very sympathetic with the Catholic Church. At first, he was supported by the Puritans because the Puritans didn't like Cromwell. The reason they didn't like Cromwell was because Cromwell wanted religious toleration. He did not want a state church. The Puritans wanted a state church. Initially, they supported him. But as time went on, they saw that he was going in a very different direction. He wanted religious toleration. The Puritans wanted a state church, which was Puritan. They did not want religious toleration. So, at the end of his rule, they threw their support behind Charles II, because Charles II was in favor of a state church. The only problem was Charles II wanted an Anglican-style state church. The Puritans wanted a Puritan-style state church. And initially they supported him, and as time went on, they withdrew their support and, in fact, were persecuted. The independents were persecuted under Charles II, and especially the Quakers that we had developed under Cromwell. The Anabaptists in general in England were ill-treated in all the other time periods. And we'll talk about the Anabaptists later. But that, his theology, which was basically Catholicism redressed, became what is known as Laudians. Those who wanted that became known as Laudians. Now, I couldn't find the dates when Charles II died. He was followed by James II, and I know that James II only ruled for about 2 or 3 years. So you can calculate for yourselves how that works out, but I don't know exactly the dates. Yep, that wouldn't be too far off. That would be within 10 years of being right. I'm sure he went past 1677. It was probably 1685 or something like that. James II. Oh, by the way, just as a point of interest, the King James Version was written under James I, and it was written in 1611. James II, he supported the Laudians. However, he wanted to move the church to Catholicism. He wanted to reunite it with the Catholic Church, and he openly said so. And he persecuted the Protestants, but he didn't live long. Virtually no one was interested anymore in reuniting with the Catholic Church. And for him to come out publicly saying that he wanted to do that was stupid. So he was, I think he was killed. And then he was followed by William III from 1688 to 1691. And by this time, the Laudian perspective is basically the perspective that wins out on the church. So what we have by this time is an Anglican church which is independent from papal control. It is theologically kind of a mixture between Catholicism and Calvinism. It's a very strange mixture. As you read through the various versions of the prayer books and stuff, you can see one line basically Calvinistic, next line basically Catholic. And it will go through like that because they were all constructed at different times in the history. And you get a mixture of the two that doesn't really fit very well. So theologically, it has some Calvinistic elements mixed with Catholic elements. But liturgically, it is primarily Catholic at this point. And that becomes the Anglican church that the present Anglican church has descended from. That church transplanted into America became the Episcopal Church. Right, there are negotiations going on right now. But everybody wants to be united in the Catholic Church right now. And there are even Protestant groups that are negotiating that. So. No, I don't think that. I think it's... Well, we'll talk about it later. But people are sensing that I'm okay, you're okay. It's kind of the perspective that's winning out. And so we ought not be divided by doctrinal perspective. We ought to see that which we all have in common and rally around that. That combined with a desire to have, to be a part of something with tradition and antiquity. Everybody's negotiating with everybody to get back together. Well, there are some other developments in theology that occur during and after William III, between then and the 1700s, that, or the 1800s. Yeah, that is William the Forge. Well, we'll stop there. There are a couple other developments. I'll just mention them briefly. Out of this Anglican church and the developments that were taking place, we have deism developing. And that was an attempt by theologians in the Anglican church in trying to combine science as it was coming along with theology. And the natural outcome of that for some of them was deism. And that starts a trend of things that we'll see when we talk about Protestant theology in the 1900s. Deus God. Deism basically, you know, deism is basically God is this impersonal force that put all this mess together and got it going and is sitting back and enjoying himself, amusing himself. And that man's job is to be moral. Your job is to live a moral life, do the best you can, well enough, and happy.